Thank you all for coming here tonight. My name is Kamel Zaidi, and I'm a freshman at Boston College. I would like to thank Mr. Chomsky for coming here speaking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. For the past 2 years, Mr. Chomsky and I have been working together on a book titled The Struggle in the Promised Land. I first contacted Mr. Chomsky my junior year of high school when I was working on a research project regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Over several years of meeting with Mr. Chomsky, I agreed to respect his opinion, and it inspired me to take action. I dedicated my book to informing more people about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. My book, The Struggle in the Promised Land, will be revealing the truth about what goes on in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and how we can work together and resolve this issue. I hope today's lecture will open your eyes to see the truth about this conflict. And now, without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce you to a man who needs no introduction, Professor Noam Chomsky.
As you know, as you just heard, the proceeds, this is in order to support the relief fund for the horrible floods in Pakistan. The United Nations describes the situation there as a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions. Malnutrition, they say, rivals the worst African famines. The worst of the flooding is in the province of Sindh. There are many villages still underwater after 6 months. This is actually a province with great inequality. A large part of it is extremely poor, and that's where the worst. That's where the worst humanitarian crisis is, and that should remind us that. Natural catastrophes are not just natural. There's a human element that's kind of brought out dramatically right now by the fact that, as I'm sure you've read, there have been huge floods in Australia, large enough so that the third largest city, Brisbane's been underwater. And there was plenty of damage and some deaths, but it's not a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions. That the difference is the human factor, not the natural factor. And we see that pretty often. There was a terrible earthquake in Haiti with maybe 300,000 people killed. Right at about the same time, there was an even bigger earthquake in Chile with a couple hundred people killed. There were some differences, but the prime difference is the human factor, the way the countries have been able to develop or have been kept from developing. And also that should remind us that we have a role in these human tragedies, not a small role. In Haiti, in fact, an enormous role, an overwhelming one. In Pakistan as well. Pakistan has suffered very severely from a series of pretty terrible dictators, military dictators. The worst of them was Zia-ul-Haq, happened to be Ronald Reagan's favorite. Under Reagan's watch, he developed nuclear weapons. The Reagan administration pretended they didn't know it so that they could keep funding him. He also carried out radical Islamization of the country. With Saudi help. That's where those famous madrasas come from that teach nothing but the Quran and train people for Islamic terror and Islamic radicalism. All that's, we have a substantial contribution to that. We've seen some pretty striking examples of it recently. As you may have seen, there was an assassination of a well-known figure, Salman Taseer, and his assassin was celebrated in the country, a huge celebration for the assassin. Taseer had opposed the blasphemy laws that had been used to punish a young woman, and the assassin was cheered and honored, one of the most, there was a big picture in the press here of lawyers, a group of lawyers who were cheering the assassin, young lawyers. Those were pretty much the same young lawyers who were opposing the dictatorship and had called for reform. Now they're praising the assassin of a figure who dared to oppose the blasphemy laws. And they are the graduates of the Zia-ul-Haq, Reagan, Saudi madrasas. It goes beyond that. There's now these two contributions of the Reagan administration, the radical Islamization and the nuclear weapons, are coming together. One of the most dramatic revelations of WikiLeaks was a series of cables from the American ambassador in Pakistan, Ambassador Patterson then, and what she was reporting to Washington was that U.S. actions in Afghanistan and Pakistan are sharply increasing the already overwhelming antagonism to the United States in the country. This is drone attacks, pressures on the Pakistani army to attack the tribal areas, which have, even under the British, were kept free from intervention, driving Afghani forces, Taliban, into Pakistan. All of this is radicalizing the country even more. And she warns Patterson that there's now, for the first time, a non-trivial threat that the fissile material for the nuclear weapons production may find its way into the hands of radical Islamist terrorists. That's kind of the ultimate nightmare. The nuclear weapons program is sharply increasing more rapidly than anywhere in the world. That's in part a reaction to India's nuclear programs, and we've had a hand in that too. A couple of years ago, first the Bush administration, now the Obama administration, has broke the changed American law and broke the regimen on transfer of nuclear technology to India. India hasn't signed the non-proliferation treaty, but we now indirectly support the nuclear weapons program by providing them with civilian nuclear technology, which is easily transferable to military uses, and also frees them to use their resources for more military nuclear weapons, and they're doing it. A year ago, the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution calling on all states to observe the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. India responded to that by, of course, saying no, and also saying that they now have weapons with the yield of the weapons of the superpowers. Of course, that inspires Pakistan to vastly expand its nuclear capacities. President Obama informed India immediately that this resolution wouldn't apply to them, and also informed Israel, which also hasn't signed the non-proliferation treaty, of the same thing. So other countries say, well, okay, us too. Pakistan hasn't signed it either. Events have consequences, and these events are partially responsible for the immense poverty and fragmentation of Pakistan, which is leading to the humanitarian crisis of epic proportions, but it's also potentially leading the way to, say, a dirty bomb in New York City or something like that. Well, the same considerations show up when we turn to the place in the Arab world, which is where the most dramatic events are taking place right now, in Tahrir Square in Cairo, and in fact all of Egypt. And what's happened there is really quite spectacular. I can't think of a popular uprising of this scale and courage and dedication, at least in my lifetime. It came as kind of a surprise, and the reason was described succinctly by a high Jordanian official who's now in charge of Middle East research for the Carnegie Endowment, Marwan Muasher. He observed that there is an operative principle that holds for the Arab world, and we can add much more generally, the principle is that as long as things are quiet and under control, we don't have to worry. As long as the people are just passive and obedient, we can do whatever we like. And in this case, what we like meant supporting the Egyptian dictatorship, harsh, brutal dictatorship. And that's an old story. It goes way back. If we want to understand what's happening there, we should learn a little of the history, not too obscure. Back over 50 years ago, under the Eisenhower administration, Eisenhower raised the question with his an internal discussion, long been declassified, and he asked his staff to why there is a campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world, and not among the governments, but among the people. And the National Security Council, a leading planning agency, came out with a memorandum on this topic, and it said something like this. It said there's a perception in the Arab world that the United States supports harsh and brutal dictators and blocks democracy and development, and we do this because we want to maintain control over their immense energy supplies. And went on to say that the perception is more or less accurate, and that's what we ought to be doing. And under the Muasher doctrine, you can do that as long as the people are quiet. As long as they're quiet, you can support dictators, and everything will be fine. Actually, Obama is following the same principle when he went to Cairo for his famous speech of reconciliation with the Muslim world. That's what won the headlines. What didn't get the headlines is that he had a press conference on the way over, and he was asked, of course, whether he'd have anything to say about what the reporter called the autocratic Mubarak regime, which is a bit of an understatement. It's one of the worst dictatorships around. And Obama said that, he said, I don't like to use labels for folks. Mubarak's a good man. He's doing good things. He's keeping the situation stable. He's a friend and an ally. So everything's fine. Under the Muasher principle, people are quiet, so we'll support our favorite dictators. Torture, repression, fabricated elections, and so on, all fine, as long as the people are quiet. Actually, that perhaps one of the most dramatic revelations from WikiLeaks was something that didn't happen. The headlines from the WikiLeaks revelations were mostly about really a significant event. The headlines read that the Arab world supports the United States on Iran. If you look at the cables, what they say is that the Arab dictators support, allegedly, who knows what they actually said, but they allegedly support a U.S. antagonism towards Iran. So everything's fine. There's something that wasn't said, namely, what does the Arab world think about this? That's known. There are recent polls taken by very respected, prestigious Western polling agencies, which have been taking polls in the Arab world for years. The most important one was released just last August by the Brookings Institution in Washington. There hasn't been a word reporting it, because who cares? Just the Arab world, the Arab population. And it turns out that in the Arab population, there's a segment of opinion that does agree with the United States. 10% regard Iran as a threat. 88% regard Israel as the main threat. 77% regard the United States as the main threat. In fact, opposition to U.S. policy towards Iran is so overwhelming that a majority, 57%, think the region would be better off if Iran had nuclear weapons as a deterrent to the real enemy, the United States and Israel. Well, Muasher principle comes in again. As long as they're quiet, we can disregard what they think. We can disregard the campaign of hatred in Pakistan. We can disregard antagonism in the Arab world until they break their chains. Then we've got to do something. And what we do is turn to a very familiar game plan over and over again. This is what's happening there is not just the Arab world. In fact, it's around the world. In fact, it even applies domestically. There are plenty of suffering in the United States, you know, not on third world levels, but severe. But as long as people are quiet, we can continue, with huge bonuses to the CEO of Goldman Sachs, stagnation of for most of the population. Everything's fine as long as people are passive and quiet, and we can direct their anger somewhere else. The game plan in Egypt is the usual one. Try to preserve the dictator as long as possible. If you can't preserve him anymore, shunt him aside. Try to sustain the existing system as much as possible, maybe with some new names. And that's exactly what's playing out in Egypt. How it will turn out, we'll see. But we can't honestly ignore the fact that we're playing a big role there and have for a long time, the British as well, before us. Well, we should, I think that what all of this should lead us to recognize is that we should be attuned to our own role in these crises around the world, sometimes massive, sometimes marginal, but almost always there, because the U.S. is so powerful. One reason is just honesty. We ought to be honest enough to understand who we are. But another is just an elementary moral reason. We can do something about a humanitarian crisis to the extent that we're involved. If we have nothing to do with it and can't do anything about it, well, we can bemoan it, but we have no responsibility to do anything because we can't. On the other hand, if we're extensively involved, as is usually the case, then we can do quite a lot if we choose. And that's a good lesson to carry over to the topic of this evening, the Israel-Palestine confrontation. There are a lot of problems all over the world. It's easy to list them. For many of them, it's extremely hard to think up a solution that would make sense and that could work. This is one of those rare cases where there's a very easy solution. Furthermore, a solution that is accepted by virtually the entire world and has been for 35 years. The solution is there is an international border which is internationally recognized. And the solution is to have a two-state settlement on the international border, maybe some minor and mutual modifications that was official U.S. policy when it was part of the world 45 years ago. So you'd have Israel as it is within its borders, a Palestinian state within the territories that were occupied in 1967. Well, there's almost the entire world supports that. The Europe, the non-aligned countries, the Arab League, all the Arab states, the Organization of Islamic States, which happens to include Iran. There's almost no opposition to it except the United States and Israel. The United States and Israel have blocked it for 35 years and still do. That's the barrier to a solution. There's no part of the world where our influence and participation is so extreme. In fact, when I talk about Israel from now on, what you should actually hear is U.S. Israel, because we're working in tandem right through this period. And it continues. President Obama came into office in January 2009. Right up until that time, Israel, meaning Israel and the United States, were carrying out a devastating attack against Gaza. Gaza is a defenseless prison. It was being mercilessly attacked by the U.S. and Israel. Obama was asked about it. He said he couldn't say anything because we only have one president. he was able to say that he deeply sympathizes with Israeli children who are being threatened by Hamas rockets, which he knew perfectly well could be stopped peacefully. I'll come back to that. He could say that, but nothing about children in Gaza who were being torn to shreds with U.S. weapons provided to in the hands of the Israeli army. The attack was very precisely planned. It ended minutes before Obama came into office. So then saved him from the necessity to say something about the attack. What he could say and what he did is, well, let's not look to the past. Let's look to the present. Let's look to the future. So he didn't have to say anything about it. A couple days later, he gave his first and to this day major speech about the Israel-Palestine conflict, which put to rest any possible thought that there might be some change in the extreme U.S. policy of rejectionism, which had prevented a political settlement. In the speech, he introduced his negotiator for the Middle East conflict, George Mitchell, which is a good choice if he has any if he would have had any leeway, but he didn't. He's now been pretty much replaced by Dennis Ross, who comes practically out of the Israeli lobby. He introduced Mitchell, and then he said that Obama, he said, well, there are, for the first time, he said, there are real prospects for peace. And he referred to the Arab League proposal, which called for a full peace agreement, full peace treaty with Israel, and she was reiterating much earlier ones, and went on to add that after the full peace treaty, the Arab states should move to full normalization of relations with Israel, new point. And Obama cited that. He said that's a big step forward. And he urged the Arab states to live up to their proposal and to normalize relations with Israel. Obama's person, he knows that that was not the Arab proposal, the Arab League proposal. The Arab League proposal was to have a negotiated two-state settlement, and in that context, to move on to normalization. By omitting the core of the proposal and saying, move on to normalization, Obama was telling us and the rest of the world that the United States is going to continue to block the political settlement, and that's exactly what has been happening since. No change from before. I'll come back to some of the details. Well, the conflict itself goes back a long time, well over a century. But a new phase, and the phase that's relevant for the immediate future, a new phase opened in 1967. Now, in 1960, that's when the Israel-Egypt-Syria-Jordan war took place and the occupied territories were conquered. Actually, at that time, in 1967, there was a major conflict going on in the region. It was between Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Now, Saudi Arabia is the center of radical Islamic fundamentalism and also the center of Islamic terror, along with Pakistan, two centers. That's one side, Saudi Arabia. The other side was Egypt, which was the center of secular nationalism. The United States supported radical Islamic fundamentalism, as it's been doing consistently, Britain even more so, and even much longer. There's a reason for that. In fact, Nasser, the president of Egypt, was compared with Hitler by the State Department and others. The reason was that it had nothing to do with human rights or anything like that. Saudi Arabia is one of the worst human rights records in the world. But it being the center of radical Islamic fundamentalism, funding terror, that's not, you know, at home, it's just as bad. But the problem was that, and Egypt was nothing pretty either, it was a dictatorship, torture, and so on. The problem was that the secular nationalist movement, Nasser and others like him, were beginning to call for use of the for taking over the resources, energy resources of the Arab world, Arab and Muslim worlds, and using them for the benefit of the people of the region. And that's unacceptable. Those resources are for our use. In fact, in internal documents, they're sometimes even called our resources, and they have to be protected, in particular from the people of the region who don't have any right to them. So secular nationalism was a major enemy. Israel performed a great service to the United States then by essentially destroying the center of secular Arab nationalism and defending radical Islamic fundamentalism. That was a great gift, and it's at that point that the U.S.-Israeli relation was solidified in its current form, the form that remains until now, major service. That's not unusual. It continues. I'll run through just a few of the highlights. In 1971, 4 years later, the new president of Egypt, President Sadat, offered Israel a full peace treaty. Everything, full normalization relations, everything, in return for Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories. Actually, he didn't really care much about anything but the Egyptian Sinai. So it was basically an offer of full peace in return for withdrawal from Egyptian territory. Israel considered the offer, decided to reject it. They were, at that time, in the midst of substantial development projects in the Egyptian Sinai. Thousands of peasants were being driven into the desert, towns destroyed, mosques, cemeteries, everything, to prepare the ground for Jewish settlements, a number of Jewish settlements, and also for a major city. And they were planning to build the city of Yamit on the coast, a city for all Jewish city of 1 million people was planned. So they made a choice at that time to prefer expansion to security. A peace treaty with Egypt, which is the only substantial military force in the Arab world, that would have meant security. But expansion was preferable. The question was how the U.S. is going to respond, as always. There was an internal debate in the United States. The State Department was in favor of Sadat's offer, not very far from official U.S. policy at the time. Henry Kissinger, who was National Security Advisor, was opposed. He was in favor of what he called stalemate, meaning no negotiations, just the mailed fist. And it was assumed at the time, both in the United States and Israel, that Israeli military power was so overwhelming that there's nothing that any of the Arabs could do about it, so we could dismiss them, kind of another variant of the Muasher doctrine. If they can't do anything, we'll take what we want. Very triumphalist spirit at that period, which they lived soon to regret. So the offer was rejected. President Sadat expelled Russian advisors to try to indicate to the United States that he wanted to become basically an American satellite. Kissinger laughed. Israel laughed. He kept saying that Yamit means war. In other words, if Israel refuses to withdraw from Egyptian territory, there's going to have to be a war. Israel and the United States paid no attention. They ridiculed it. It's good literature on this, incidentally, in Israel. I tried to get it translated, but no American publisher would touch it, so you can read it in Hebrew or French, but not English, the French translations. And it basically describes an arrogant, racist, triumphalist attitude. Arabs don't know which end of the gun to hold. We can do what we like. 1973, Sadat followed through on his warnings. There was a war, and for Israel, it was a very close thing. Worst danger in the history of the state. They came close to destruction. They were even beginning to plan to use nuclear weapons as a last you know, last step. Finally, with the massive U.S. military aid, they managed to turn the tide. But Kissinger realized, and the Israeli leadership realized, that they can't simply disregard Egypt. They can't regard it as a basket case. At that point, negotiations began, the famous shuttle diplomacy, you know, Kissinger flying up and back. Finally, in 1978-1979, at Camp David, the United States and Israel more or less accepted Sadat's 1971 proposals, actually in a form then which was harsher from the U.S.-Israeli point of view, because in the interim period, Palestinian national rights had entered the international agenda, and Sadat was insisting on Palestinian rights. I mean, Carter, who was the American president, accepted it. Menachem Begin, the Israeli prime minister, claimed to accept it or rejected it. But Israel and the United States did agree that Israel would withdraw from the Sinai. And that's the peace treaty, 1979 peace treaty with Israel and Egypt. Now, that's described here as a great diplomatic triumph. Look, we brought peace to Israel and Egypt. Actually, it's a diplomatic catastrophe. By rejecting the proposal in 1971, Washington paved the way for an extremely dangerous war. Lots of suffering and misery, terror, violence, and finally agreed to something like the proposal that they'd rejected in 1971. Well, that's the actual story, but not the story you read. You can easily check up the details. They're not obscure. Well, meanwhile, as I say, the Palestinian issue had entered the international arena. The 1971 proposal of withdrawal by Sadat offered nothing to the Palestinians. It just treated them as refugees, no national rights, nothing else. But that changed. In 1976, January 1976, the major Arab states, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, what are called the confrontation states, the ones in direct conflict with Israel, they brought a resolution to the United Nations Security Council calling for a settlement on the international border, which would, with Israel within its territory, a Palestinian state and the territories that Israel would evacuate. And then they added the wording of UN 242. That's the resolution that everyone agrees, at least in principle agrees, is the major operative resolution that calls for a recognition of the rights of every state in the region to live in peace and security behind internationally recognized borders. So that's what the January 1976 resolution called for. Israel refused to attend the session. The United States vetoed the resolution. That happened again in 1980 under Carter. I won't run through the rest of the record, but it's about the same. Regular resolutions, usually at the General Assembly, overwhelmingly supportive of a two-state settlement. The votes are maybe 151-2, U.S. and Israel. Sometimes the U.S. picks up some Pacific island or something like that. But that's the regular voting record, and it continues right up till the present. In fact, to this moment, right now, the Security Council is considering a Lebanese resolution supported by about 120 countries, which calls for Israel to terminate expansion of settlements in the occupied territories. And it also, the resolution declares all the settlements to be illegal. Well, the fact that the settlements are illegal is not even controversial. In fact, Israel agreed to that back in 1967. I'll come back to that. Withdrawal, ending settlement expansion is official U.S. policy. Nevertheless, the United States indicated at the Security Council that it's right now trying to block the resolution. It says if it's voted on, the United States will veto it. That's what they've been indicating at the Security Council, which is an effort to prevent the resolution from being even considered. Well, that's our current position. Let's go back to 67, when Israel conquered what are the currently occupied territories. Very quickly, Israel began settlement activities, partly in the Sinai, the ones I've mentioned, partly in the West Bank. The question came up whether inside Israel, whether this was legal. Israel's highest legal authorities informed the government that any settlement in the occupied territories is in violation of a core international law. The Attorney General agreed. He said, yes, that's certainly true. In the cabinet, the defense minister, Moshe Dayan, who was in charge of the occupied territories, he agreed. He said, yes, of course, the settlements we're beginning are illegal, but countries violate international law, and we'll do it too. And they can, as long as the boss says it's okay, just as India and Israel can violate the non-proliferation treaty, as long as the boss in Washington says that's fine, it doesn't apply to you, and so on, just as the United States itself can freely violate international law. We have the authority to do it, self-determined, and if we like, we apply it to our clients and allies. So Dayan was correct. Yes, they can violate international law if they like, and they proceeded with the settlements. That they're all illegal is not even in question. It's repeatedly been affirmed not only by the highest Israeli authorities, by the Security Council, by the International Court of Justice, with the U.S. Justice agreeing in a separate resolution that any settlement in the occupied territory and anything done to protect them, any infrastructure for them, is de facto in violation of international law. But that unanimous position, and incidentally the U.S. voted for many of those Security Council resolutions, it doesn't matter as long as the boss says you can violate international law. So the settlements are illegal, and it's understood, but they can continue as long as the United States provides the critical diplomatic, military, economic, and indeed ideological support. The ideological support is by suppressing most of what happened. So, for example, the facts I just mentioned, which are not in the least controversial, you know, you can check them yourself, there's no question about them, they're unknown because we have a very efficient doctrinal system that allows certain things through and other things not through. It's just like, say, what's happening in Tahrir Square or what happened in Gaza during the U.S.-Israeli attack last year. You could see live television footage of it 24 hours a day if you're in any country outside the United States, namely by watching Al Jazeera, a highly respected channel. But in the United States, you can pick it up on the Internet, but you can't watch it on television because we're closed. Or to be precise, there are two small cable stations in the country that agree to run it, but no one else. So free society, but we have mechanisms of constraining the information that reaches the public, and they're pretty effective. So I add ideological support to the diplomatic, military, and economic support. For example, the current discussion about the veto of the Lebanese Security Council resolution, it's not totally suppressed. I think there were five lines about it in the New York Times, but you have to be a pretty dedicated researcher to find out any of these things. And a lot more. I'm sure you know there were headlines about this. President Obama sent a special representative to Egypt, Wisner, old CIA background, to convince, to talk to Mubarak, to try to, in theory, to try to ask him to resign. Robert Fisk, British correspondent, very good British correspondent, he was able to expose the fact that the American press either couldn't find or didn't want to find that Wisner is a member of the major lobbying firm for Mubarak. That's the person you send to Cairo to convince Mubarak to move to the side. Well, there are only two possibilities. Either the Obama administration is, you know, incompetent to a level that's almost unimaginable, like they couldn't find, discover that what a British journalist could, that their representative is part of the major lobbying firm that lobbies for Mubarak, or else it's just pure cynicism. It's the standard game plan. We tell them quietly, we really don't care, maybe you should move aside and your sidekick, Omar Suleiman, should move in. He's the U.S. choice now, and a reasonable choice. He's the head of the Egyptian intelligence, responsible for terror, the person responsible for rendition. When the U.S. wants to send people to be tortured, rendition, send them to places like Egypt, where they're pretty good at torturing people, and Suleiman's in charge of that, so kind of a good person. But try to learn something about it, say the Wisner rule. Well, Israel and the United States have a program for the West Bank and Gaza, and have had for years. You can see it developing in front of your eyes. Israel now controls about over 40% of the West Bank. The program that's being implemented, which basically comes from General Ariel Sharon, the main expansionist, was described by Prime Minister Olmert, past Prime Minister, as what he called convergence. Israel will take over whatever is valuable, essentially. That includes the land behind what's called the separation wall, actually an annexation wall. It's a wall that snakes through Palestinian territory, leaves on the Israeli side arable land, control over the main water resources of the region, and also the pleasant suburbs of Israeli cities, Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, big infrastructure projects connecting them to Israel. So Israel will take that over. It'll take over the Jordan Valley, from which Palestinians are being excluded and Israeli settlements are going up. That essentially imprisons what's left. Also, there are salients cutting through. One big one to the east of Jerusalem. It actually started in the 70s, but it developed mostly under Bill Clinton. That one pretty much partitions the West Bank, north and south. There's a big Israeli town, Ma'ale Adumim, which has borders going almost to Jericho, meaning if you look at the map, it virtually partitions the West Bank. There are two more salients farther north, which break up the rest of the region. And there's substantial expansion around what's called Jerusalem. Jerusalem, remember, is not Jerusalem. Jerusalem was vastly expanded by Israel when it occupied it. It's probably five times its original size, settled with Jewish settlers. That's doubly illegal. Not only is it in violation of Security Council orders and world court decisions with regard to settlement altogether, but it's in violation against of specific Security Council resolutions related to Jerusalem, which actually the U.S. Signed on to at that time. They were back in the late 60s when the U.S. was still part of the world on this issue. So that's multiply illegal, but it continues before our eyes. Open the papers every day, you see new development going on there. So that big area, Israel has in fact annexed in violation of the Security Council orders, then comes the rest of what I described. That leaves to Palestinians a little over 50% of the territory. Right now it's about 40%, which is essentially unviable. I mean, there can be development, say, in Ramallah, with European money coming in, so elite groups can live in, you know, relatively well, and bars, theaters, you know, good, nice residences. In other words, a standard neo-colonial arrangement in which elites live reasonably well, the cooperative elites, and the rest, it's their problem, they suffer. There's a military force now, security force, it's trained by U.S. General, General Dayton, with the cooperation of Israel and the Jordanian dictatorship, and its main goal is to control the Arab population, the population of the West Bank. That's doing a pretty good job. For example, during the attack on Gaza, the U.S. and Israel expected some reaction in the West Bank to this devastating attack last year, 2 years ago. There were no demonstrations in support, and the reason is they were suppressed. They were suppressed by the Dayton Army, the Palestinian Security Force, which also, you know, arrested people who might protest and so on. This was, in fact, the suppression was so effective that General Dayton himself informed the U.S. that Israel was able to dispatch forces from the West Bank for the attack on Gaza, freed up forces, because the Dayton Army had the situation under control. That was very impressive to U.S. leaders, like Senator Kerry, our senator, who heads the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and is kind of Obama's point man for the Middle East region. He gave an important speech in which he said that at last, after many years, Israel has a legitimate negotiating partner, namely the Palestinian Authority, and the prime reason was the Dayton Army. And now there's an army trained by the U.S. together with Israel and Jordan, which is capable of controlling the population. So now there's a legitimate negotiating partner with whoever will be willing to effectively capitulate to U.S.-Israeli demands. That's the U.S. position. That's the position of the Obama administration being implemented before our eyes. Not a big secret, or it shouldn't be. There's also a policy for Gaza. Starting in 1991, Israel made the decision that there's no point holding on to Gaza. It had already been virtually ruined under Israeli occupation, so let's forget about it. And they began to separate Gaza from the West Bank. For now almost 20 years, there has been a dedicated U.S.-Israeli policy to separate Gaza from the West Bank, split Palestine in two. That's in direct violation of the Oslo agreements, signed at about the same time, which declared that the West Bank and Gaza are a territorial unity. But again, the boss can do what he likes. We can sign a treaty agreement and celebrate it and decide to violate it. Who cares? As long as people are quiet and don't do anything about it. And that means us, for example, specifically. And the policy has continued. It's extended through these years, often very violently. I won't go through the details. It took a big step forward in January 2006. The Arabs, the Palestinians, committed a major crime. I have to suffer for it. What happened in January 2006 is that there was a free election, actually the first and only free election in the Arab world, carefully monitored, determined to be free and fair. But the Palestinians did something quite criminal. They voted the wrong way. They voted in favor of Hamas, which the U.S. opposes. Well, you know, we're all in favor of elections when they come out the way we want. Otherwise, we're against them. That's a policy not just for this region, but overwhelmingly. I mean, the evidence for that is, I won't talk about it if you like afterwards, but it's just overwhelming. It's essentially the case that the U.S. supports democracy if and only if it accords with strategic and economic objectives. Now, that's much as recognized even by conservative scholarship. And this is a case in point, a dramatic case in point. Elections came out the wrong way. Within days, the United States and Israel determined publicly to punish the Palestinians for this crime, voting the wrong way in a free election. And the punishment was pretty severe. Substantial siege, a lot of violence, attacks. It went so far as cutting off the supply of fresh water for the arid Gaza Strip. Well, continued on like that. July 2007 got much worse. What happened is that the U.S. tried to, with Palestinian support, Palestinian Authority support, tried to carry out a military coup to overthrow the elected government. The coup was preempted, and it didn't work, and Hamas took total control of the Gaza Strip. Well, that was considered an incredible crime. You can't, how dare you, block a U.S. military coup to try to overthrow an elected government. And the siege tightened, became much harsher. There's a real ongoing, continuing humanitarian crisis there of an enormous, at an enormous level. In June 2008, there was, meanwhile, Hamas and other groups were starting to fire primitive rockets across the border. Okay, that's a criminal act, but, you know, by comparison with everything else that's going on, it's minuscule. But that's, of course, what we talk about. There was a ceasefire in June 2008 between Israel and Hamas. The terms of the ceasefire were that Hamas would end rocket firing and that Israel would lift the siege. A siege is an act of war. It's not controversial either. In fact, Israel of all countries absolutely insists on this. Israel went to war twice, aggressive war, 1956 and 1967. One of the main pretexts was that Israeli access to the outside world was hampered, not stopped, but hampered by closing the Straits of Tehran, which could be Egyptian territory, that's debatable. So then they went to war. So yes, a siege is undoubtedly, a full siege, like on Gaza, is obviously an act of war. And it's very brutal. The fishing boats are driven to shore where they can't fish because Israel has destroyed the power and sewage plants, so contamination is horribly contaminated. Palestinians are driven away from the border. If anyone goes in there, say, to farm his land, he could be killed. There's just constant attacks and the cutting off of all but the bare means of life. In fact, as Israel has stated, they don't want to kill all the people. They just want to keep them on a diet, just enough to survive. The agreement in June 2006 was Hamas would end the rocket attacks, Israel would lift the siege, open the territory up. Well, Hamas lived up to the agreement 100%. Israel recognizes officially, you can find it on the government website, that there were no Hamas rockets fired. Israel, however, did not live up to it. It maintained the siege. Nevertheless, Hamas lived up to it. In November 2008, the day of the U.S. election, Israeli forces invaded Gaza, killed half a dozen militants, and at that point, rocket fire resumed both ways. Rocket fire from Hamas, Israeli attacks. People were killed, all of them Palestinian, but that's the normal ratio. The ceasefire ended in December. Hamas called for the ceasefire to be renewed. Israel considered the offer, rejected it, decided instead to attack. Notice that that attack has been condemned by the human rights organizations, by the Goldstone Report, and others, as being disproportionate, which is true. It was wildly disproportionate. In fact, it was major crimes. But that's kind of missing the point. If one bullet had been fired across the border by Israel, it would have also been a crime. The constant rhetoric about this, which is correct, is that Israel has a right of self-defense, which it certainly does. Everyone has a right of self-defense. But there's a little proviso. Do you have the right of self-defense by force, by violence? Well, the answer is only if you've exhausted peaceful means. In this case, peaceful means not only were not exhausted, they weren't even tried. So therefore, it's no right of force and self-defense. The U.S.-Israeli attack was just a plain war crime, crime of aggression, period, disproportionate or not. Well, again, that's one of those things you don't talk about, but the facts are straightforward. The attack was awful. I won't go into it. The siege was afterwards was maintained. A couple of months ago, there was an attack on a ship, a Turkish-flagged ship, by Israeli forces, the Mavi Marmara. It was attacked in international waters. That's piracy. Israel also killed 9 people in the attack, Turkish citizens, 1 American citizen. That caused great anger in Turkey and a lot of furor around the world. There was also a reaction in the United States. Congress overwhelmingly approved the attack. Israel's kind of surprised by the international reaction, and with a certain amount of justice, because Israel's been carrying out a piracy and hijacking on the high seas for about 30 years, attacking ships, traveling from Cyprus to Lebanon, killing people, kidnapping people, bringing them to Israeli prisons where they are often held as hostages for a long period. So what's the fuss? We've been doing this for decades. Why are you making a fuss about this? So there's some justification in Israel's surprise at the reaction, except in the United States where there's no reaction. Well, there was enough international protest so that Israel officially said that they would ease the blockade, the siege. There's a report that came out shortly after, a couple of months afterwards, by a coalition of international aid groups, Oxfam, Red Cross, and so on, and they concluded that almost nothing had been done. I'll just read the wording of the director of Amnesty International. The so-called easing of the Gaza blockade does not change the fact that there's still a cruel and illegal blockade collectively punishing the entire civilian population. The only real easing has been the easing of pressure on the Israeli authorities to end this cruel and illegal practice. Well, again, there's a qualification. There's been no easing of the pressure here because it's logically impossible. The U.S. exerts no pressure, so there's nothing to ease. In fact, not only that, it participates directly in the crimes. So what we're seeing is a rare event in history. A leading Israeli sociologist called it politicide, the deliberate murder of a nation. Not much like that. I'll just say a word about what lies behind this. There are many factors. The obvious question is, why is the United States standing against the world in blocking a political settlement for 35 years when there is one? Now, there are many factors. One is what I mentioned earlier. Israel was performing and continues to perform major services for the U.S. in the region and later elsewhere. There are strategic reasons. In the last 40 years, there have been growing military and intelligence connections, which are extremely close. So close, in fact, that another WikiLeaks exposure was a list of sites throughout the world that the United States considers essential for strategic purposes. One of them is right near Haifa, town of Haifa in Israel. The headquarters of Rafael Military Industries, one of Israel's major military industries. That's a major strategic site for the United States. In fact, connections are so close that Rafael has moved a lot of its management offices to Washington, where they can more easily obtain grants and set up research and development relations and so on. It goes beyond military industry is very closely related to Israel, Lockheed Martin and others. And it goes beyond to high-tech industry generally, which is quite supportive of Israel and invests there increasingly. One of the most striking cases is Intel, the leading chip manufacturer in the world. It has now designed a new generation of chips, which it assumes will take over the global market, and the main factory for producing them is in Israel. And that extends quite widely, with substantial support. So these are the reasons why, if you take a look at public support for Israeli atrocities in the United States, it's very closely related to the business community. Now, the most extreme support in the press is from the Wall Street Journal, the journal of the business community. The Republican Party, which is just so deep in the pockets of the business world, you need a telescope to find them at this point, they're the most extreme in support of Israeli crimes and aggression. Democrats are highly supportive, but Republicans more so. And it reflects the attitude of the business world towards their Israeli ally and client, along with military and intelligence. There's much more than that. It's not usually understood that Christian Zionism goes back way before Jewish Zionism and is extremely powerful in England, but primarily in the United States. The United States is off the international spectrum in religious extremism by just about any measure you can think of. So a third of the population, for example, considers that every word of the Bible is literally true, including the words that say God promised the land, Palestine, to the Jews. And that's not just kind of end times and evangelicals. That's mainstream elite opinion. When the British general Allenby conquered Jerusalem from the Turks in 1917, you could read in the Washington Post and the New York Times that this was Richard the Lionhearted finally driving the pagans out of our country, the Holy Land. It was the Crusades were finally vindicated. He was called Richard the Lionhearted, General Allenby, honored for that. Woodrow Wilson, progressive president at the time, he read the Bible every morning. He was deeply immersed in Orthodox Christianity. And for him, return of the Jews to Palestine was, that's God's will. Same went on through the Roosevelt administration. One of Roosevelt's leading advisors, Harold Ickes, described Jewish colonization as an achievement without comparison in the history of the human race. And so it continues through elite circles. It's a significant factor, and of course the extreme evangelical circles, which are a pretty big part of the United States, is a passionate supporter of Israeli crimes. They're also extremely anti-Semitic. They're the most anti-Semitic group in the world. If you read their doctrines, all of this is supposed to lead to Armageddon, at which point everybody's destroyed except those who have been saved and they rise to heaven. Among the Jews, 144,000 are saved. The number, I suppose, comes somehow from the 12 tribes, but whatever it is. 144,000 are saved, the rest are condemned to eternal damnation. I mean, even Hitler didn't go that far. But they're the strongest supporters of Israeli actions. So that's all substantial. There's a kind of an intuitive support for Israel among the general population. Israel's a settler colonial society. Now, that's the worst kind of imperialism. Traditional imperialism sort of leaves the population there and rules over them. But settler colonialism eliminates the population. And that's our history, after all. We're a settler colonial society. The pilgrims and their successors effectively exterminated the indigenous population. In fact, extermination is a term that was used by founding fathers. They're mostly gone. And that's considered very noble, you know, it's part of our heritage. And the recognition that Israel's kind of following something like the same course, it kind of strikes a chord in the American population, gives a kind of instinctive sympathy. Now, there's also a big Israeli lobby, one of the most influential in Washington, though in fact it's dwarfed by the military lobby and the business lobbies. Well, without going on, there's a lot of support for these rejectionist policies, and that means there's going to be a lot of work to do to try to overcome them, but it also means that the roadblock going to, there is a an straightforward solution attainable to the Israel-Palestine conflict, not a very beautiful solution in my opinion. It should be only my own view, a path towards something better, but it's there in the short term. There's a roadblock. The roadblock is right here, and that's actually an optimistic conclusion because it means we can do something about it.